From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A senior U.S. official said the Director of Central Intelligence, Mike Pompeo, met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un earlier this month in preparation for a possible U.S.-North Korea summit involving Mr. Kim and President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump Tuesday hosted Japan's prime minister at his Florida Mar-a-Lago resort. Mr. Trump acknowledged the much-talked-about historic meeting may not even take place.
We'll either have a very good meeting or we won't have a good meeting, and maybe we won't even have a meeting at all, depending on what's going in. But I think that there's a great chance to solve a world problem.
Mr. Trump said several venues are being discussed for such a meeting.
We have not picked a site yet, but we've picked five sites where it's potentially going to be. We'll let you know fairly soon. And let's see what happens.
Mr. Trump also said North and South Korea have his blessing to discuss an end to the Korean War, which was halted in 1953 by an armistice. They're scheduled to hold their own summit next week. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, said Mr. Trump is being realistic about the prospect of a U.S.-North Korea meeting.
He has good advisors who've told him that North Korea is unpredictable, it's mercurial, and that something may happen, so it's best not to get one's hopes up about the summit.
Mr. Abe is in Florida seeking U.S. assurances about North Korea's nuclear program, the issue of Japanese abducted by North Korea, and trade. Human Rights Watch said Burundi's government, along with ruling party members, have beaten and killed perceived opponents of an upcoming referendum to allow President Pierre Nkurunziza to extend his rule. The brutal campaign, it said, was designed to intimidate people to vote in the May 17th referendum. This is VOA News. There are conflicting reports about whether international chemical weapons inspectors have been allowed to visit Douma, the town in Syria suspected of being the target of a poison attack April 7 that left more than 40 dead. It prompted a U.S.-led retaliatory strike. Syrian state-controlled media said the experts from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons have arrived, but U.S. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert Tuesday said she's not so sure.
Our sources, which we consider to be reliable, indicate that the team has not yet been able to enter Douma. So that is our understanding of the situation, at least as of right now.
Nauert said it's vital the inspectors be allowed to determine whether toxins were used.
We want them to be able to get in as quickly as possible, as safely as possible, but we also want that evidence to be as pure as possible for their investigation.
France said it's likely evidence of a poison attack was disappearing before the inspectors even arrived. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov asserted Monday on a BBC interview no such attack occurred.
All the evidence which they quoted was based on the media reports and on social networks.
Meanwhile, Syria Tuesday began shelling Yarmouk camp, another rebel-held position south of Damascus. Former U.S. First Lady Barbara Bush has died. She was 92. She was the wife of former President George H.W. Bush, the 41st president, and saw her son George W. become the 43rd president in 2000. Larry Sabato is a political science professor at the University of Virginia.
She was active at the highest levels of politics for six decades, which is really remarkable to think about. And she participated on a daily basis in 16 campaigns by her husband and her two sons, George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, 16 campaigns.
Sunday, the family issued a statement saying Mrs. Bush was in failing health and decided not to seek further medical treatment. An engine on a New York to Dallas Southwest Airlines flight with 149 on board apparently exploded Tuesday, sending shrapnel through the fuselage, killing a passenger, injuring several others, and nearly sucking another out a damaged window. The crew was able to make an emergency landing in Philadelphia. The new U.N. mediator for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, told the Security Council Tuesday he hopes to kickstart negotiations to end the conflict in Yemen.
My plan is to put to this council within the next 2 months a framework for negotiations. There is good news and bad news, and I apologize for this cliche, but it is the truth. The good news, and this is my principal message to the members of the council today, is that a political solution to end this war is indeed available.
The war has killed thousands, displaced millions, and created the world's acute humanitarian crisis. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Thousands flee Mali to escape extremist and intercommunal violence.
The new arrivals in Burkina Faso include 2,000 Malian citizens, as well as 1,000 Burkinabe who have been living in Mali for many years. The new displacement adds to the challenges faced by people of the region.
William Spindler is spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency. More than 200 child soldiers were freed yesterday during a ceremony in South Sudan. Two Rwanda families reconciled 2 decades after the country's genocide. Liberia mourns the deaths of 2 journalists this week under different circumstances. And Zimbabwe celebrates 38 years of independence today, Wednesday.
The sacrifices made by our heroes and the heroines must inspire us all to be loyal, dedicated, and to selflessly save our mother country.
Plus, President Emmerson Mnangagwa in Senegal this week is hosting the Pan-African Malaria Conference. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The UN Refugee Agency says a spike in intercommunal violence in central Mali has sent about 3,000 people fleeing for their lives to Burkina Faso over the past few weeks. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency warns intercommunal violence is on the rise between the Dogon and Payil communities in the Koro area of central Mali. Since February, it says dozens of people have been killed and homes and other property destroyed as clashes between the two groups have increased. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says his agency fears more people will flee as extremist and intercommunal violence escalates.
The new arrivals in Burkina Faso include 2,000 Malian citizens, as well as 1,000 Burkinabe who have been living in Mali for many years. With many afraid to travel by road for fear of kidnappings and murder, they arrive via unofficial border crossings on foot or in light vehicles. The new displacement adds to the challenges faced by people of the region.
Before this latest influx, Burkina Faso had been hosting some 24,000 Malian refugees since the start of Mali's conflict in 2012. These new arrivals are putting more pressure on the humanitarian needs and the ability of aid agencies to meet them. Spindler says food is in short supply and health facilities are overstretched. He says most of the new arrivals are living with friends or relatives in hard-to-reach areas. He says UNHCR is urging them to move to a refugee camp further away from the border where they could be registered. He says they would have access to basic social services there and be better protected from rising banditry and violence in areas hosting Malian refugees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
More than 200 child soldiers were freed yesterday at a ceremony held in Bikiria, about an hour's drive from Yambio, the capital of Buduo State. This is the second release of children in a series of supported by the children's agency UNICEF and the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Nabil Biagio attended the event in Yambio and has the story for The Voice of America.
The children dressed in various military and police uniforms march in unison in a symbolic military parade. Then they lay down their weapons and remove their military fatigues as instructed by a commanding officer. They put on UNMISS-issued T-shirts decorated with the hashtag Children Are Not Soldiers. Several government officials, along with representatives of non-governmental organizations and diplomatic missions in South Sudan, attended the event. Some of the freed children were abducted by the rebels of the South Sudan Liberation Movement, or SSLM. Others were kidnapped by the SPLA-IO rebels and forced into military service. A 13-year-old boy, whom we shall call Michael to protect his privacy, says in his native Zande, he was abducted more than 4 years ago.
I was abducted by 5 men who showed up while I was out fetching water. They told me not to run or scream, and then they took me with them. The men belonged to the SSLM.
During his 4 years with the rebels, Michael was forced to fetch and carry water long distances, collect firewood and cook. He says he was trained with wooden rifles because he couldn't carry a real gun. He was released when the SSLM rebels signed a peace deal with the government and was reintegrated into the army earlier this year. 15-year-old Asunta is another child soldier abducted by the SSLM rebels. Speaking in her native Zande, Asunta says she was abducted in late 2015 while she was walking with her father.
I was going to the farm with my father. Then the rebels attacked. My father ran, and I was captured and taken by the rebels of the SSLM.
Asunta claims she and other kidnapped girls were raped repeatedly by rebel commanders for months.
In the first week, three other girls and I were forced to fetch water and cook for the rebels. Then after that, we were forced to be the wives of a rebel commander there.
Matthew Di Cristofano is a child protection officer with the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. He says his agency will provide care for the newly released former child soldiers.
We are rescreening and assessing some of the children who are being released to determine if they have any immediate and urgent needs, such as requiring a care arrangement or interim care. All of the children who are screened following today will be assigned social workers who are going to follow up and monitor those children for the next 6 to 12 months, depending on their individual needs.
Di Cristofano says the children will also receive trauma counseling and other types of support.
We're also going to be providing reintegration services to include psychosocial support, both counseling for those children who have experienced more serious traumatic events or have acute psychosocial distress needs.
Today's event marks the second major release of children by the warring parties. The first took place in Yambio town in early February, when more than 300 children were either returned to their families or released to UNICEF-supported care centers. UNICEF estimates that some 19,000 South Sudanese children are still held by various armed groups around the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaju in Juba.
Zimbabwe is today, Wednesday, holding ceremonies marking 38 years of independence from the United Kingdom in 1980. This is the first independence commemoration that founding President Robert Mugabe will now preside over after resigning last November due to pressure from the military. Sebastian Mofu has details from Harare.
On the eve of Zimbabwe's 38th independence celebrations set for this Wednesday, President Emmerson Mnangagwa has urged the country's youths to enjoy their freedoms guaranteed by the country's constitution.
This freedom we are enjoying today, as young people, the sacrifices made by our heroes and the heroines must inspire us all to be loyal, dedicated, and to selflessly serve our mother country. The future that lies ahead is promising. As government, we have set out a vision to create a Zimbabwe for you, which is a middle-income country characterized by increased investments, decent jobs, broad-based empowerment free from poverty and corruption.
This is the first time since 1980 that Robert Mugabe won't lead the celebrations for Zimbabwe's independence from Great Britain after he gave in to military-led pressure last November and resigned as Zimbabwe's president. But some youths say there is nothing to celebrate given high unemployment rate and poverty in Zimbabwe. Tamuka Charakupa, one of the youth, says there is nothing to celebrate on this 38th independence anniversary of Zimbabwe, the first ever since the founding leader Mugabe resigned. Tamuka talks about not being able to get a job 2 years after finishing his degree in journalism. He will join thousands of nurses on the unemployment line after President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government fired them late Wednesday. The nurses embarked on an industrial strike a few days ago to push for improvement of working conditions. So it seems there are mixed feelings on this 38th independence anniversary. On one hand, some Zimbabweans are celebrating, while other citizens, like the dismissed nurses and some youth, are concerned about lack of jobs. The Zimbabwean government had said it was considering the nurses' quote, genuine and valid grievances, unquote. At the same time, the government said it was broke to immediately meet the nurses' demands. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Today is Wednesday, April 18th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. Liberia this week is mourning the deaths of two journalists under different circumstances. The body of young journalist Tyrone Brown was discovered Monday this week after witnesses said it had been dropped at his residence at 3 in the morning. The Press Union of Liberia says Brown was murdered in cold blood. Brown's death comes amid what some are calling attacks on journalists by President George Weah's government. Information Minister Eugene Nnamdi says the government has launched an investigation into Brown's death. Also yesterday, Tuesday, former Press Union of Liberia President Abdoulaye Camara met his untimely death after suffering a stroke. Daniel Nyankona, Secretary General of the Press Union of Liberia, says the journalism community is shocked and saddened by Camara's death.
What we know now is that the hospital in Banga, Bong County, confirmed him dead, and they say he died of hypotensive stroke, which caused him some damage to his brain. But it's what the hospital confirmed today.
Are you saying hypertension, meaning high blood pressure?
Meaning high blood pressure, yes.
He was former president of the Press Union. How is the Press Union taking his death?
We are all devastated. The journalism community is shocked, very much saddened. That disrupted normal work of the journalism community today. People rush across various newsrooms. We gather in Banga, receive his body, and then we took it to town, maybe, as you know, Adelaide, devoted mostly. So we took the body to his home. His relatives receive it in keeping with Islamic practices. And tomorrow he will be interred in his village in Grand Kipnor County. But we are very, very devastated. This is in addition to the death of another journalist just within the space of less than 30 hours.
Yes, Daniel, I'm thinking you are referring to Tyrone Brown, the journalist who died, I think, is this week. Press accounts I'm reading refer to his death as gruesome murder. Is that the view of the Press Union?
Yes, this is the view of the Press Union. There is no doubt that he was murdered. He was thrown on to the road, dead, and it was confirmed by the Benson Hospital. And then the police, the forensic team intervened, and they reported deep cuts on his body at three different points. So clearly, yeah, this is very despicable crime. He was murdered in cold blood. A young, promising professional coming out, a video editor, as well as a cameraman and reporter. Very enterprising and multi-taxing individual in the newsroom.
This is coming on the heel of some contentious relationship recently between the press in Liberia and the Liberian government. I read where the Minister of Information, Eugene Nnamdi, is promising swift investigation into the death of journalist Tyrone Brown. Are you in touch with the government in terms of the investigation?
Yes, we've called on the government of Liberia to speedily investigate the death of Tyrone Brown to the Liberian National Police. That investigation, we want to include an autopsy that will give us a full report, an exhaustive report on what the cause of death is. Because right now, as you talk about the recent escalation of attacks and intimidation of journalists in the country, with this very, very gruesome death of a journalist, this has sent fear in the journalism community. So we want the government to the Liberian National Police to act civically so that their report can reassure the journalism community that we can live freely in Liberia and work as journalists doing what we know best.
Daniel Nyankona is the Secretary General of the Press Union of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. A plea for forgiveness and an unexpected marriage have brought two Rwandan families together 24 years after the genocide that claimed more than 800,000 people, mostly Tutsis. VOA reporter Edward Rema recently visited Rwanda and has the story of how the son of a confessed killer married the daughter of a family who lost relatives at the hands of the father.
The village of Buguri is just a few kilometers away from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. It was in this village 24 years ago that Silas Bihizi joined other ethnic Hutus in killing his Tutsi neighbors. Among those murdered was Valence Ruchiriza's brother, the man's wife, and their three children. Bihizi was arrested in early 1995 for actions he has come to abhor and spent 13 years in prison. He was released to face a community-based court that included victims, relatives and friends set up to speed prosecutions in the genocide. During the trial, he confessed, asked for forgiveness and was sentenced to 13 years, which was the time already served.
Among those who participated, I was among them. That resulted in being accused of killing Rukiriza Valens' family. That included his sister-in-law, children, and his elder brother.
After his release, he returned to his wife, their seven children, and his farm work. But he worried about meeting the relatives of his victims, something inevitable in a small village.
After my release, I decided that confessing to a crime during trial wasn't enough. Then I decided to go to the home of those that had endured a lot because of my crimes and ask for their forgiveness. I apologized because I wanted to free my soul.
Rukiriza, whose brother Bihizi had killed, was the key witness against Bihizi. During the trial, Rukiriza argued Bihizi should be sentenced to life in prison. Forgiving someone who ripped his family apart was difficult, but Rukiriza decided to pardon him and move forward.
We accepted his apology as a family, but of course that wasn't easy. It required a lot of strength. At first I hesitated, and my neighbors can attest to that. I felt I could not do it, but thanks to God, I had to accept the apology. Our government encourages us to promote unity and reconciliation and to coexist peacefully.
A big step came in 2009, 2 years after Bihizi's release. His son, Stanislas Nyomungeri, approached him with plans to wed Iasent Muraire, Ruchiriza's daughter.
When he told me that, it felt like he had opened an old wound. Well, I had asked for forgiveness for the crimes I committed, but I couldn't imagine having to face Rukiriza again to tell him that my son wanted to marry their daughter.
Muraire's father initially resisted too, but the young couple were deeply in love.
My fiancé used to tell his friends that if I don't marry that girl, I would commit suicide. He repeated those same threats to my family when we visited them. Then my father asked why he should go through that. It is then that I made a decision. Instead of losing him, I would rather stay away from my family if they opposed our marriage.
Ruchiriza said he relented and blessed his daughter's marriage because he wanted to support reconciliation.
Hating reconciliation is adding a heavy burden on yourself. It leads to a lot of stress. If I had not been courageous enough to accept to forgive, I would be a useless person by now. I wouldn't be the man I am now. I would be a drunkard here. I had that courage, and God helped me through that process.
Today, both Ruchiriza's and Bihizi's bloodlines commingle in three young, beloved grandchildren. Edward Rwema, VOA News, Buguri, in southern Rwanda.
Malaria experts are meeting this week in Senegal's capital, Dakar, to discuss the continuing fight against the disease and how it can be eradicated. Malaria infected more than 200 million people in 2016, and more than 90% of those cases were in Africa. Professor Omar Gay, the head of the University of Dakar's Department of Medical Parasitology, spoke to Ricky Stryak ahead of the conference about the hope for a vaccine as well as funding challenges.
We have new tools regarding prevention, regarding also treatment, and we have made substantial progress regarding also vaccine. And we think with the new tools and the agenda to malaria elimination could be achieved in the coming years. But by the same time, also, we are facing some challenges. Resistance of parasites, resistance on vector, and for those the things also we need to share our different experience and look at what would be the next step.
Can you tell me a little bit about the developments in malaria prevention that you are speaking about? That you mentioned vaccine is.
Yeah, for vaccine we have one candidate, the RTSS, which has a very strong progress, and by now the consensus is to do a pilot study in three African countries to look at really some specific issue. But at this pilot study, we will go to implementation and it will be the first vaccine really candidate, the first vaccine which will be implemented for malaria prevention. So we think really it's a very strong achievement within this specific cluster.
The pilot study is happening this year, is that correct? And in what countries?
It will be conducted in three countries, in one in West Africa and two in East Africa.
According to the 2017 Malaria World Report, in 2016, there were 5 million more cases than in 2015, for a total of 216 million cases of malaria, 90% of which happened in sub-Saharan Africa. What do you think caused this rise in malaria cases? Is it just a population increase? What caused this rise?
Yeah, I guess the main challenge is really the financing, because really if you want to achieve substantial progress, we need a universal coverage and accessibility to all the different services, such as the diagnostic treatment and also PET-NET. But due to lack of funds, also the progress can be stopped.
What are you looking forward to the most when it comes to this conference?
Yeah, we are confident because really we have strong stakeholders, and also we have the head of state of Senegal upon the ceremony. And I think strong message will be launched really to do more for malaria. And really, it's time for Africa really to make the difference.
That was Professor Omar Gay, head of the University of Dakar's Department of Medical Parasitology. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Senegal's capital, Dakar. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The UN Refugee Agency says a spike in intra-communal violence in central Mali has sent about 3,000 people fleeing for their lives to Burkina Faso over the past few weeks. Zimbabwe is today Wednesday holding ceremonies marking 38 years of independence from the United Kingdom in 1980. This is the first independence celebration commemoration that founding President Robert Mugabe will not preside over after resigning last November due to pressure from the military. And that is it for this Wednesday, April 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari says he will seek his party's presidential ticket to contest elections in February 2019, ending months of speculation about his future. The future of 75-year-old Muhammadu Buhari on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.